this morning is 17-6149, Smith versus Aldridge. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Jones, and I represent the petitioner or appellant in this case, Radon Smith. I would like to concentrate my remarks this morning on one aspect of the appeal that I believe is the most crucial one, and that is the section of 2254D2. As the court is familiar, 2254D contains two subsections which are applicable in the alternative. And the statute provides that when a claim was adjudicated on the merits in the state court proceeding, a federal court may not grant relief on that claim unless the state court adjudication either, in subsection 1, provides, as it does, and then subsection 2 says, or 2, resulted in a decision that was based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in the state court proceeding. And that is the basis for my oral argument today.
Mr. Jones, am I correct in reading your footnote 2 in your reply brief to say that is the basis, sole basis, of your sleeping juror argument? It seemed to me in footnote 2 you disavowed pursuing any sort of D1 argument as it relates to the sleeping juror. Is that correct?
I think we were swimming upstream on D1, Your Honor.
So the answer is yes?
Yes.
Okay.
First, there may be a susceptibility to believing that some hearing was held below. There was never any hearing.
Before you get to that, was the OCC entitled to make a factual determination on the record before it, did it make a fact finding that, you know, basically crediting the trial court's testimony or written order? So two questions. Can the OCCA make a fact determination on a record without an evidentiary hearing, and then did it do so here?
The first answer to the first question is yes, it can. And two, it attempted to make a factual determination that, in my opinion, was blatantly unreasonable. And that's the basis of our argument. That finding by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals was unreasonable.
No reasonable jurist could make that conclusion.
No, sir. And here's the reason why.
Yeah,
not.
Why?
First of all, Judge Vassar, who was the state district court judge, made the statement that the court relied upon. And that statement is quoted in the entirety in the brief. But when Judge Vassar made that statement, he did not have before him the five jurors' affidavits, four of whom were members of the panel, and the fifth one was an alternate. What Judge Vassar was talking about was the affidavits that had been submitted before, and particularly the nine people from the audience, because this is what he says. The jurors were faithful and conscientious to their duty, and any attempt to say otherwise maligns them. Well, that would mean that the jurors themselves who signed the affidavits under oath were maligning themselves, and yet these are the jurors that found Ms. Smith guilty.
I find that argument curious because I don't see Judge Vassar relying upon the affidavits that were before him at the time. He was relying on his own memory, his own recollection. So if I'm sitting there and I say the light's red, the fact that five people want to come up and say the light's green doesn't change the fact that I think the light's red, does it?
It may not change it in his mind. The question is whether the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals should have conducted a hearing on that. After all, they sent down a hearing which was heard by Judge Boyd on the limited question of juror L.O., and even Judge Boyd said that he would have preferred to have the entire matter of the jurors before him.
That's a statement of preference. What we're talking about is whether, was there any sort of clearly established federal law that would have required the OCCA to conduct a hearing?
Well, the established federal law is a decisional law that if the facts before them are straining credulity to believe that they could make that determination without hearing any witnesses, just because one of them is the judge that presided and five of them are the jurors that heard the case, four of whom voted on it, plus the other circumstances in the case, Judge Vassar was clearly wrong. And
if there are dueling affidavits, it would be unreasonable as a matter of law for the OCCA not to grant an evidentiary hearing?
I don't think you can make an absolute rule, but each tub sits on its own bottom.
Counsel, that's a very important question to me, and very straightforward. If there's dueling affidavits, does the fact that they choose one over the other by itself make it an unreasonable determination?
Well, limited the way Your Honor, by itself, but that's not what we had here. What we had here was one affidavit versus five, and there's no suggestion, since the judge admits they were conscientious, that those jurors are wrong.
What indicates then that the judge was wrong? We've got to decide that it was an unreasonable determination.
It was an unreasonable determination.
No, that's your
position. And all you have to do is read the judge's comment.
I have.
This is what he said. The following is the court's observation. During the course of this trial, as with any trial, I constantly and zealously view the jury in order to ascertain whether or not they are alert and attentive as required by the court's instructions and the law. Okay, so in this small courtroom, which actually was the municipal courtroom in Bristow, Oklahoma, which probably was eighth the size of this room, in a major case of, in reality, a homicide case, with massive public interest, with people lining across the walls and every seat filled, we are to believe that the judge, not including the emotionalism of the evidence, is concentrating entirely on watching the jury. Now, the jurors' own affidavits point out that in several cases, bailiffs or court clerks told them to nudge jurors. The judge himself says that one time he watched a juror sleeping, and that juror says she was sleeping.
Whoa. Is there any basis to believe in the record, and I didn't see any, is there any basis to believe that the one juror that the judge identified in its statement was L.E., and that was in a parenthetical in your opening brief, I think. Is there any, and without a citation to the record, is there any basis in the record to connect those two?
Other than the logic of the circumstances.
The logic of the circumstances.
Yes.
Well, the logic of the circumstances would mean we'd have to take your assumption that L.E. was in fact sleeping, right?
I don't think, well, L.E. says she was
sleeping. Well, she says she was. The judge didn't say she was.
The other four jurors said she was. And she said she had a potassium deficiency and she was sleeping. So are the other four jurors who are sitting as close to her as to the edge of this table or that table wrong?
Fact finders always have to decide between facts.
It doesn't mean that fact was right. It was an unreasonable interpretation with no hearing ever held on these issues before any court. And we are entitled to that hearing to say that a judge who on the record admits himself that twice he told the jurors to stay awake, that he says he was constantly, zealously watching them, suggests and in fact compels the conclusion that at least one of them was sleeping, and that's verified by that juror herself and her colleagues who are sitting as close to her as packed sardines.
Let me focus for a second on this question of a hearing. In your reply brief, for the first time, you cite Cullen versus Penholzer, and Cullen would seem to eliminate the possibility of an independent hearing except for a determination that this was an unreasonable determination of facts. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that.
Okay.
I do. I say that for some reason, no court ever granted a hearing, and we didn't just have dueling affidavits. The court is entitled to consider who wrote the affidavit, what their basis of knowledge and observation was, what they did when the events arose, and all of that suggests and in fact compels the conclusion you had at least one juror that was sleeping continuously through the trial, and particularly on the 2 days that he admonished the jury, even if we assume for a moment it's not LE, those were the 2 days where the most important element of the defense was presented to the jury.
And let's talk about that. Isn't there the state raised a preservation issue as it related to those 2 days that you argue were days that were critical, and therefore they were days that would have affected the prejudice as it relates to the juror sleeping? They indicate that you didn't raise that argument in the district court before the magistrate judge. As I understand, your retort to that was you raised it in your objections to the district court. Do I understand you correctly?
That is correct, but it's also in the record.
Well, wait a minute now. Is that the first time, though, that you raised it in your objection to the district court?
Well, I'd hesitate to say because it's a voluminous record, but I don't recall any earlier incident.
Okay, well, if there's no earlier incident, we have precedent that says it's waived. A specific argument related to those 2 days, if the first time you raise it is before the district court in an objection, it's waived.
Well, but the difficulty I have, Your Honor, with that thought is that's what Judge Vassar said, those 2 days. So I'm relying on just what the record says he said. But is it necessary to go that far? Because the record is overwhelming that this juror was asleep all of the time.
Okay. Now, with that, refresh my recollection. In my looking at it, was there ever an objection raised in that trial to the judge that the juror is sleeping? By the attorney. Was there ever?
I don't know that there was an objection by
the
attorney.
Well, it's important to me, and it's your record that we're looking at. Was there ever, to your knowledge and looking at the record, because I don't see it, was there ever an objection made by counsel that the jurors are sleeping, Your Honor, and they're not paying attention?
Number one, we did raise the question that the counsel didn't do it, and the answer to your question is he didn't do it.
That's right.
Neither did the state, and we've raised that in our argument. But to get there, you have to first decide, I believe, whether this is an unreasonable application. After all, the jurors were told by other jurors and by a court bailiff and by the judge and by a court clerk they needed to stay awake. So I don't think that the appellant's relief depends upon whether her lawyer stood up and added to the course that this juror is sleeping continuously during the trial.
But you've raised an ineffective assistance of counsel argument based upon the failure to object.
I do.
Right? And so are those two arguments, do you agree those two arguments are linked? In other words, if you lose on the unreasonable determination of facts, you lose on the IAC argument, right?
Yes, that's okay. True. But the reverse is not true. I can win on the unreasonable argument and lose on the question of ineffective assistance of counsel.
True enough.
I come back to the question that the trial court says that did not happen unequivocally. Isn't that correct?
Well, he doesn't say it didn't happen unequivocally. He says that he told the jurors twice to stay awake and that he noticed one juror nodding off, as he says it, I believe it, but he didn't notice it again. So given the circumstances and the facts established about a sleeping juror, it is clear that there was such an instance.
You know, it's there's obviously a continuum at stake here, and you know, jurors are distracted. Jurors from time to time daydream. You know, don't pay attention to the record. And is the best interpretation of Ellie's affidavit and the others that she was continuously sleeping from, you know, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. during the taking of evidence? Or was it somewhere in between that she nodded off from time to time?
There's no measure by the clock given in her affidavit, but the word continually has some meaning in the English language, and it means continually. That's another way of saying she was asleep all the time, except those times when she was nudged awake.
Right, and neither the trial judge nor defense counsel or prosecution, nobody noticed that except a fellow juror, right?
fellow jurors in the best position to notice it, absolutely the best position, because their attention is directed to what's going on. They don't have other things distracting them. And if the juror next to them is asleep most of the time, they most assuredly know it.
Thank you, counsel. I'll let you reserve some of your time. Hear from the Attorney General.
May it please the Court. My name is Theodore Pieper, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Respondent Warden. This case began with the tragic death of a 2.5-year-old child and petitioner's subsequent conviction for enabling child abuse. The issue before this Court is very simple, just whether the Court of Criminal Appeals unreasonably determined the facts in light of the evidence in the state court proceeding. And the answer is no, they did not make an unreasonable determination. Therefore, there is no occasion for this Court to apply de novo review. There was no occasion to hold an evidentiary hearing in this case.
What's the basis, then, to credit the trial court's order over the other witnesses? I mean, it's basically a he said, she said situation. There's been no credibility determination because neither the trial judge nor the jurors have been examined. You know, we just have a paper record here. Why would you credit one affidavit over the other?
Your Honor, two things about that. First of all, there is a history of deference to trial court observations on this. In Randleman v. State, which is an Oklahoma case, the court said it's a 1976 case, but it's the case that the judge actually cited in making this observation. It says that the judge should make his observations a part of the record in deciding upon such an issue. Compton v. Hartley, which is a District Court of Colorado case that the magistrate relied on, also says that where evidence relating to alleged juror misconduct is conflicting, we defer to a trial court's findings that are based on its own observations. So one, there is that history of deference to the trial court's observations there. But two, we don't just have the trial court's words versus the affidavits in this case. We also have the whole trial court record, the whole trial transcript in which there were only two mentions of a sleeping juror ever. Actually, there was really the second mention is really not anything about a sleeping juror at all. It's just the trial court's giving admonitions at the end of the day. Remember what I said about keeping your eyes open. Remember, you know, to follow my rule and not consider outside evidence.
Because the court didn't say there was ever another incident of a sleeping juror, right?
That's right. In their affidavit, Judge, really, he just said, I observed one juror on one occasion who appeared to be asleep, and I admonished the jury and recessed the court. So there's really only the one instance that's present in any part of the record outside of the affidavits.
Well, in a sense, though, we're flying blind. You know, if true, you know, this situation is a kind of breakdown of the trial jury function, it seems to me that we could, you know, answer the question fairly simply by having an evidentiary hearing in this case to see whether Ellie's affidavit is credible. That seems like a simpler outcome than, you know, deference to a paper record where there's really been no credibility determination.
Your Honor, I would argue that that's what the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act requires in this case, though, is just to review the paper record because there was a decision on the merits. The magistrate says, the factual disputed issue here, whether Juror Ellie slept throughout petitioner's trial, is one that the OCA expressly determined in the state's favor. And we have Cullen v. Penholster and Black v. Workman and the plain language of 2254 D2 itself that says that we're going to defer to what the state court found there unless the petitioner actually meets that burden of proving that it was completely unreasonable. Furthermore, I believe that it's interesting, Your Honors, that what the affidavits say, it's interesting what's not in the affidavits. There's no showing of prejudice made in the affidavits except just using vague terms like continually. This court in United States v. McKeegan says that you know, a trial court is not invariably required to remove a sleeping juror, and they have discretion in determining how to manage that situation. It is telling that the trial counsel, you know, we have all these affidavits from the jurors, but we do not have anything from any court official that would corroborate what the jurors are trying to say in those affidavits. We don't have anything from the bailiff, just except for hearsay statements contained within the affidavits. Trial counsel for defendant offers a 38-paragraph affidavit right around the same time that the jurors are making these affidavits, which is completely silent on this issue. And it's really telling that no attorneys said anything on the record about this. With the trial court making that one warning on that one occasion, that should have alerted everybody to be looking for this issue. So I think the fact that you never see another objection for the rest of the trial is very significant here.
Your arguments, you know, it seems like no matter how much evidence the defense marshals to support its argument, that, you know, we credit the trial judge and, you know, one against ten doesn't matter. The court always wins.
Your Honor, it's not a situation of blind deference to what the court says always. However, you also have to look at the trial record in this case. And, you know, in frankly, in all of the other cases that I read on this in preparing for this argument, I can't see another case where there was no objection whatsoever that a juror was sleeping. And I just really feel that that's very significant here because there were three attorneys for the state, there were two attorneys for petitioner, and all of them had a vested interest in this case. It wasn't just the judge had a vested interest in the case. All of those attorneys had an interest in making sure that the jury stayed awake and paid attention to what they were trying to present. There was vigorous direct examination, vigorous cross-examination, and everyone had the same interest, really, in calling this to the court's attention if they saw any further problem with it. So it's not just deference to the trial court's observation here, but it's also the record. It's the trial record and the court's observation versus these affidavits. Also, Your Honor, with respect to this issue of, you know, days two and four, and whether, you know, the evidence was particularly critical on those days, yes, that was an issue that was not raised until the objection to the report and recommendation in this case. Beyond that, another point, though, that I want to make about that is that some of the witnesses that petitioner has cited in there as falling on day four, they were not even on day four. Patty Bonner and Dr. Kelly Kuhn, they were day five. Yolanda Hunter's cross-examination actually occurred on day five, so her direct examination concluded on day four. She continued on day five. So even the attempt to show prejudice there really doesn't state the record correctly, Your Honors.
And can you answer, counsel, in looking at the docket sheet, at the state trial in regards to this matter, you said there were three, assistant district attorneys, and there were two representing the defendant.
That's correct.
Were they court-appointed? Were they CJA? Were they, you know, what were they? If you know. If you don't, then don't bother to answer it.
Your Honor, I am going to not bother to answer that. I believe I know the answer, but I'm not for certain on that.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors, again, I would just say, you know, the burden to overcome D2 is really high. Petitioner has not shown that there was any misapprehension or misstatement of the record here. The court clearly at least looked at these affidavits, at least looked at the trial court's observations in making this determination, and therefore we don't have an unreasonable determination of the facts here.
And that is really what we're focused on, right?
That's correct.
And then why do you repeatedly in your brief try to get us to give deference to what the federal district court found? You cite Hickman versus Spears for that proposition. We have later said that Hickman only comes into effect if we are not under the framework of AEDPA. We're focusing on what the state court did, not what the federal district court did, right?
Your Honor, if I gave the impression that I'm arguing more for deference to the magistrate than to what the Court of Criminal Appeals held, I apologize for that. You are correct. This court owes deference to what the Court of Criminal Appeals held under the AEDPA. But, again, at the end of the day, the question is this completely unreasonable? Because if reasonable minds can disagree on this, then under Wood versus Allen, this court needs to affirm what the Court of Criminal Appeals found.
And even if we think that this Court of Criminal Appeals is wrong, that's not enough, right?
It's not enough. They have to be completely unreasonable and not merely wrong in order for petitioner to prevail. Your Honors, if you have any further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. You concede your time. And Ms. Shoemaker, if you give Mr. Jones 2 minutes for rebuttal.
And in answer to your question, Your Honor, the case was prosecuted by the District Attorney of Lincoln County, who was not a legal resident of his own district. He subsequently moved into the district after I raised the point that Oklahoma County was not entitled to two district attorneys. He lived in Edmond. His associate counsel was a lawyer in private practice, and under the rules of professional ethics, he was barred, but that was not raised either by trial counsel. The two counsel representing Ms. Smith were retained. The only point that I want to make in the minute left to me, or 2 minutes left to me, the court has spoken this morning, and I have spoken about the credibility determination, judge versus the five affidavits. May I respectfully submit to the court that it is Judge Vassar himself who said the jurors were very credible, because in the last sentence of his order, which the Court of Criminal Appeals relied upon, he says the jurors were faithful and conscientious to their duty, and any attempt to say otherwise maligns them. Respectfully, I believe the state is maligning them today and suggesting that they either lied in four or five affidavits or they were mistaken. I believe they were speaking honestly, raised a credibility determination, and if we could remand a judge Boyd, as the Court of Criminal Appeals did on the issue of LO, they could have remanded on the issue of LE. But that would have required Judge Vassar to testify, and that wasn't going to happen. I respectfully submit that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals decision was unreasonable in the application of the facts, and that it should be remanded to the state courts for an evidentiary hearing on this issue alone.
Thank you, Counsel. We appreciate the arguments. Those were very clearly stated and helpful, at least to this judge. Counsel, you are excused. Our final case will be submitted, and the court will be in recess until further notice.